All right, we are continuing our study of the Gospel of Matthew here on the Listener's Commentary, and this recording is part two of Matthew chapter 16, verses 13 through 28. So let's just summarize where we're at in this passage so we keep the whole flow of it together. Jesus and the 12 have traveled north out of Galilee up to Caesarea Philippi. It's a large Gentile region. It's got a famous temple to the god Pan. It also had a large temple to the emperor, so it's a pagan area, Gentile area. Jesus has traveled there with the 12 and is increasingly spending more and more time with the 12, preparing them and training them, getting them ready for ministry, and getting away from some of the crowds and the opposition in Galilee. So he's traveled there, and Jesus asked his disciples who people say that he is. And they answer with, well, some say John the Baptist, some say one of the prophets. And then Jesus asked them, well, who do you say that I am? And Peter, speaking on behalf of the 12, confesses that Jesus is the Messiah and the Son of the living God. He's not like one of these false pagan gods. No, he's the Son of the living God. And in the context of Matthew's Gospels, we said in the last one, that seems to have the full force, more than just a royal title, to that there's something more there, at least for Matthew as he's written this, we were beginning to sense. Or now we know that he's not just king, he's also the Son of the living God. And Jesus affirms that confession and says that he's going to build the congregation of his people on it, and that Peter, in some sort of way, will have a leading role in that project. So now, having affirmed that confession, Jesus needs to help them unlearn some of their expectations for the Messiah. They had a picture of what the Messiah was going to be. They bring that with them. When Peter confesses that Jesus is the Messiah, that picture is in their mind, and Jesus needs to help them unlearn that and see what being the Messiah really means in terms of who Jesus is and what his vocation, his mission is. And so beginning in verse 21, that's where we pick up. Jesus says this, "From that time on, Jesus began to point out to his disciples that it was necessary for him to go to Jerusalem, to suffer many things from the elders, chief priests, and scribes, and to be killed, and to be raised on the third day." All of this is intended to provide new content, fresh content into what it means to be the Messiah. They had a different picture. For them, the Messiah was this powerful royal figure, this conquering king, this somehow God's agent of liberation and going to set them free from their oppression and bring them back to kind of freedom and prominence on the world stage. That was the dominant picture of the Messiah of the day. And Jesus has to help them unlearn that. So notice that it says, from that time on, we're here beginning to pivot in the story of Matthew's gospel, and we begin to shift our focus now on Jerusalem and what will happen when Jesus gets there. And it's not going to be long in the flow of Matthew's story until that moment comes. Maybe historically we're 9, 10, 12 months out from that, but in terms of chapters of Matthew's gospel, we only have a few left, and Jesus will ride into Jerusalem. And what Jesus says here is that he's on a collision course with the Jerusalem leaders. And not only does this help them maybe unlearn some of their expectations and hear what kind of Messiah Jesus really is and what his mission really entails, it also is the first of several predictions of his death that Matthew will highlight over the next few chapters. And so Matthew's wanting us as readers to pay attention to that. Jesus historically is wanting to help the 12 see that, yes, indeed, he is the Messiah. He's just not that kind of Messiah. And so together with them, we're beginning to get a picture of what kind of Messiah is he? Well, he's going to be killed by the leaders of his people. In fact, he says here, notice, it's necessary. Like, it ought to happen. It has to happen. It's necessary for it to happen. That he must go to Jerusalem and die, but he also says that death will not be the end, that he will be raised up on the third day. And so this is the picture that Jesus wants them to have and us to have of what it means for him to be the Messiah. And it's so radically different than their expectations for the Messiah that it doesn't fit. They don't know what to do with it. It doesn't make sense. And they immediately object. So look how Peter responds in verse 22. "And yet Peter took him aside." He pulls Jesus aside from the others and began to rebuke him, saying, God forbid it, Lord. This shall never happen to you. In essence, Peter is saying, No. That's not what messiahs do. That's not who messiahs are. And so if you're saying you're the messiah and you're agreeing with my confession, well, messiahs are triumphant heroes. So there's no way that's going to happen to you. God would never allow that. That's what Peter is saying. Notice how Jesus responds to Peter, verse 23. But he, Jesus, turned. So it's like he physically turns his back on Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan. You're a stumbling block to me, for you're not setting your mind on God's purposes, but on men's." And so Peter is being, notice, fulfilling really the role of like the tempter here. That's why Jesus says what he says, "Get behind me, Satan." Like, you're actually the mouthpiece of temptation. You're a stumbling block to me. You're trying to trip me up and get hinder me from going through with the calling that God has placed on me, what it means for me to be the Messiah. And Jesus explains why. Because you're not setting your mind on God's purposes, but man's. In other words, you have man's idea of what needs to happen and what the Messiah needs to do. You have man's agenda for that, not God's. You're thinking about things the way people think about them. Your values, your goals, your strategies are those of following human beings, and God has a different plan. So Jesus is redefining messiahship, and he's helping them understand what it means for him to be the Messiah, and he's saying, "You guys are right. I'm the Messiah, but I don't think that means what you think it means." And by Jesus' day, rebellion was in the air. Every now and then, some Jew would get a notion that he was going to be the Messiah and he was going to be the great deliverer. And here's how it usually worked. He would raise up a following of people, 50, 100 or whatever, and they'd gather knives and their swords and they'd plan some sort of attack on the Romans in their regions, and they would stir up the local populace into revolt. And then the Romans, being a trained military as they were, they would kill a bunch of them, put them all down, maybe even crucify a handful of them, and it would silence that would-be revolt, and that was that. Well, that sounds exactly like what Jesus is saying is going to happen to him. And Peter and the others are like, "No way." But Jesus has a different vision of what it means to be the Messiah. He doesn't gather an army. He doesn't stir the populace up into violent revolt. Instead, he's going to lay down his life for them. And that's what he's already beginning to help them see and understand in these words to Peter and the 12. And not only that, he actually calls them as his disciples to imitate him. Look what he says in verse 24. "Then Jesus said to his disciples, 'If anyone wants to come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me.'" Here is the call to discipleship. If anyone wants to actually be a follower of Jesus, he or she must take action. They must imitate, right? Like, discipleship entails imitation. So if Jesus is going to take up his cross, discipleship requires followers to take up their own cross. Notice what Jesus says, that discipleship entails three things here. Denying yourself. He must deny himself. And that is, in the context, the original setting of Peter and the 12, part of that means we've got to deny our own agenda, right? Like, Peter has his own agenda and his own vision of what messiahship should be and how salvation should work and what it all mean. He's got to deny that, not your way, but Jesus's way. So deny himself, take up his cross. This is what followers do. Take up their cross. And the cross wasn't a beautiful, you know, gold pendant hung around your neck on a necklace. It was an instrument of torture and death. So take up your cross. And it was well known. They knew the agonies and the horrors of it. Take up your cross and die and follow me. And one of the ways I like to say this is that turning to Jesus requires dying to self. That's just the nature of it. If you want to convert and follow Jesus, then that entails dying to self and choosing a new approach to life. And for Jesus, that means laying down his life for others. And so Jesus continues in verse 25 to explain this. "For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it." Notice that. Saving your life, if you want to save your life, that is preserve it, protect it, advance it. In the context of Peter and Jesus here, Peter is doing that by rebuking Jesus. He's full of self-interest. He has a picture of how he wants things to be. And Jesus is saying, no, that's preserving your life. And if you do that, you're going to lose it. But whoever loses his life will save it. That is, losing your life entails renouncing control of it, surrendering ideas of what life is, how life must go, what constitutes life, opening your hands, letting that go, and saying you have to give all those things up and just follow me. Jesus continues the explanation in verse 26 and says, "For what good will it do a person if he gains the whole world but forfeits his own soul? Or what will a person give in exchange for his soul?" The word translated soul is the same word translated life in verse 25. So that's the connection. They've just translated it differently. I just wish sometimes translators would be consistent so we could hear it, we could follow it. The soul means yourself. It means your life, right? Like your own sense of being, your own personhood. So whoever wants to save his life, that is whoever wants to save himself, save him, his being. And whoever wants to save his own soul, right? That's the idea. So verse 26 is following that up by saying, for what good will it do if a person gains the whole world? You've got the whole world. You've got everything you could possibly imagine. And yet in the process, forfeits his life, forfeits his self, forfeits his own being, his own soul. Or what will a person give in exchange for his own soul? Like what is your soul really worth? What is your life, your being, your essence, your true self? What is that ultimately worth? That's the idea. Then Jesus goes on in verse 27 and says this, "For the Son of Man is going to come in the glory of his Father with his angels and will then repay every person according to his deeds." And so there's going to come a day where there will be accountability, where there will be glory. But that day, Jesus says, is not now. That will happen, but now he's going to go to Jerusalem and he's going to lay down his life. And discipleship will require imitating that, following that. And if you do that, you will be recompensed. You will be rewarded, paid back according to your deeds. In fact, every person is going to be held accountable and repaid for what they've done. The Apostle Paul puts it in 2 Corinthians chapter 5 as, that you will be repaid. Each person will stand before the judgment seat of Christ and be repaid for the deeds done in his body, whether good or bad. That day will come. But first is going to come self-sacrifice. In fact, Jesus goes on then, speaking of his coming in glory, he says this in verse 28, "Truly I say to you, there are some of those who are standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." Now, what does he mean by that, and how does that fit into the context here? Well, the initial point that Jesus is making is, even though he's going to suffer and die, that does not negate his kingship, it does not negate his messiahship, and it does not negate the fact that he is bringing in the kingdom of God and will continue to do so. So his kingdom is going to come, and he will be the King of glory. That is the case. And he even says here that it'll happen soon. Notice, even during the lifetime of some of those standing there, truly there are some of you standing here today who won't taste death until they see this. So whatever Jesus is talking about, it was something that he knew would happen in the lifetime of some of those standing there. So what does that mean? What does it mean it'll happen in their lifetime? Well, Jesus certainly didn't return during their lifetime. So if that's what he was talking about, well, then he made a mistake. He was wrong. And I just don't think that's the case. I think that's us imposing our own thoughts on Jesus rather than trying to understand what Jesus actually meant. In fact, Jesus, throughout his ministry, consistently says that no one knows the day, only the Father. So it would seem odd if Jesus all of a sudden made a prediction of his return here. He even says throughout his teaching that he himself doesn't know. So that just wouldn't make sense. So he had to mean something else by some of those standing there won't taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Well, here's what seems likely to me. Two things. First, Peter, James, and John are about to get a glimpse of Jesus' glory in a week. In fact, it's the very next episode in Matthew's gospel, and Matthew connects it to these words of Jesus with this very precise transition statement, 6 days later. And so it seems like that's intentional on Matthew's part. He wants us in some ways to see what happens in the Mount of Transfiguration and Peter, James, and John, who are standing there that day, seeing Jesus' glory there. So I think somehow that connects with what Jesus is getting at. Also, Jesus' death and resurrection, with then the consequent pouring out of the Spirit on the day of Pentecost, inaugurates the kingdom of God in a new and powerful way. Like, Jesus is bringing it in, and ancient promises and prophecies are coming true in Acts chapter 2. That's why Peter there in Acts chapter 2 actually quotes from the prophet Joel. And that is like the initial opening the doors of the kingdom, and Peter has a central role in that, and that's all part of the context here. And so I think that is what Jesus is getting at here, is that the kingdom of God, like, when Jesus says the Son of Man, notice that, coming into his kingdom, this is a clear echo of Daniel chapter 7, where that Son of Man language derives from, and where the Son of Man comes, not to earth, but to heaven, into his glorious kingdom, sits on his throne, and now reigns as king over a universal kingdom. That's the picture in Daniel 7. That's what they would have heard. And so that's what we're talking about here. This is talking about the vindication of the Son of Man. Yes, he will be crucified and rejected, right? But he will be resurrected, and he still will be king of power and glory. He still is the Son of Man, and he still will sit on his throne over God's universal kingdom, just as Daniel 7 promised. And so to wrap up this section, what we see here is that in the first half, Peter and the 12 get the identity of Jesus correct. He is the Messiah. He is the King of Glory. He is the great Son of Man promised in Daniel 7. They get that right, but Peter, and presumably the 12 along with him, don't understand what that means. And so Jesus now has to explain to them that I am the Messiah, but I'm not that kind of Messiah. I am a Messiah who will suffer and die, who will be rejected by his people. But that does not negate the fact that I'm the Messiah, and I still will enter into glory. I will be vindicated by God. I will sit on the throne at the right hand of the Father, just as Daniel 7 predicted. And so as we reflect on this, what this really reminds us of is that the way of Jesus is the way of the cross. And those of us who want to be followers of Jesus, we live in a world that glorifies retaliation, that thinks the way to accomplishment and power and to removing of evil is oftentimes with attacking and violence and revolt. That's what everyone expected the Messiah to be in Jesus' day, but that's not the kind of Messiah that Jesus was. Jesus knew that there's a greater way, a better way to deal with evil and death than violent revolt. He knew that the Father's plan was for him to lay down his life, and he calls his followers to imitate that and to live their life in the way of the cross, dying to self, taking up the cross, and living like Jesus lived, with self-sacrifice and self-emptying. And that's why in the book of Revelation, what we see is the followers of Jesus specifically being said that they overcame him by the word of their testimony and that by their own death. They did not even love their own lives unto death. That's the way of the cross. And so may those of us who are followers of Jesus imitate him by taking up our cross and following him just as he took up the cross for us. Thanks for tuning into this session of the Listener's Commentary on the New Testament. The Listener's Commentary is a listener-supported, crowd-funded Bible teaching ministry that's made possible by the generosity of tons of folks just like you. So thanks a ton to those of you who support this ministry. And if you have been blessed or impacted in any way by this ministry, would you prayerfully consider joining the team of supporters? The easiest way to do that is to go to listenerscommentary.com, click the Give button. It'll redirect you to my page at World Family Mission, a registered nonprofit that serves as like an umbrella organization for independent ministries. And you can set up a one-time donation right there, or you can give a recurring monthly donation. Thanks a ton in advance for your support.